studied cosmology. He's a very famous cosmologist. A good percentage of what we know as cosmology today was built by him. That's, I think that's a good approximation. So I guess he finished back at Princeton, the same graduate school, the same before from which I finished, only 20 years before I did. He went on to do lots of different things. He worked mainly on cosmic microwave background, larger scale structure, and lots of different halo formation, lots of different important problems. In cosmology, so right now he's a chair of physics at MIT, we really miss him in cosmology. We hope he soon comes back to us. So he's going to tell us about gravito-electromagnetism. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nayash. Thank you, everyone, for showing up, and thanks for the invitation. This is really a beautiful place. You're quite right. You told me that it was a hospitable and a great place to work, and so far my impressions confirm that. The topic I've chosen is probably unusual for a cosmology seminar, but cosmology and gravitation are, of course, very much linked. And I've chosen this subject because it's one that I've been concentrating on for the last few weeks with my graduate student, Robin Sanderson, who is a co-author in this work, and he should be coming out with a preprint on this work in a couple of weeks. The background for this is the confusing subject of gravitomagnetism and gravitomagnetic effects. There's lots of terminology associated with this. Frame dragging effects, for example. Lens tearing precession. There is, of course, the Gravity Probe B satellite that aims to measure gravitomagnetic precession, sometimes called Pugh-Shift precession. There is a lot of ambiguity and some confusion in the literature about the precession of gyroscopes and the precession of orbits. And I'm going to say something about that today. And then there are, of course, many claims that gravitomagnetic effects have already been measured in the binary pulsar system, in lunar laser ranging, and perhaps even with LAGEOS satellites. Well, I'm not going to talk much about the experimental situation. In fact, I really won't touch on the experimental situation. But I want to try to add a little to our understanding of what we mean by gravitomagnetism and why there has been so much confusion in general relativity and how we might clarify matters a bit. So this will be a pedagogical presentation. I'll give it in the form of a Blackboard lecture. Well, I want to start where one would perhaps expect in making the comparison between gravity and electromagnetism. We know electric forces. We understand, well, the Newtonian analogy between Newtonian gravity and electrostatic forces. And we learned as undergraduates how to deduce the existence of magnetic fields from electric fields via Lorentz transformations. So let's recall how this goes and see if we can apply those same arguments to gravity. So I'm going to start simple. With just the force on a charge Q. This is, of course, if the magnetic field is zero. This is electromagnetism. We haven't got yet to magnetism, but we'll see how it follows from Lorentz transformations and then try to make the correspondence with gravitation. So let's take special relativity. And we'll use it in two ways in this derivation. The first is simply the relativistic momentum. Because if we insert the momentum and carry out the derivation and actually solve this equation for a simple system, we can deduce terms that will look like magnetic terms in different frames. So I want to take a sheet of charge. surface charge density sigma. This gives an electric field moving away from the charge sheet. And the magnitude of this electric field in SI units is just the charge density divided by twice permittivity. Okay, it's very easy to combine and work out the motion to solve for the trajectory of a charged particle. So we're going to follow the motion of a little charge Q with mass m. And we find that its trajectory, if it starts at rest from some vertical distance z0, is given by this, where A is just the acceleration the charge has starting from rest. Okay? So that's a freshman physics type calculation. Now let's do a Lorentz boost and view this motion from a frame moving horizontally with speed u. So in the boosted frame, along the particle's whirl line, there is a time dilation. And I'm going to use the speed u to denote the Lorentz boost speed, and I'll reserve v for the velocity of the charge particle. And because the boost is transverse, the z coordinate of the trajectory is unchanged. And now, writing the trajectory in terms of the time t prime, one can differentiate to get the velocity components in this prime frame, the momentum components in the prime frame, and then just check this law of electricity. And what one finds, of course, is that it's no longer true in this moving frame that the acceleration or the force is strictly proportional to charge. There's another term proportional to the velocity of the particle in the prime frame. So one deduces, in other words, the existence of magnetic forces in the moving frame. And in the particular case, it's straightforward. I won't give the results for the fields in the prime frame. But of course, the general case gives the familiar formula. For the Lorentz transformation of fields. I'm sure you've all seen this as undergraduates. So let's go back to the beginning and ask, can we repeat this derivation with gravity? Newtonian gravity, what would change? Well, we'll replace the surface charge density by a surface mass density. We'll have an attractive acceleration field, a gravitational field G. And just like I wrote the trajectory in terms of the initial acceleration, I can do the same here. And in fact, one recovers exactly the same solution. Of course, now the acceleration is proportional to the gravitational constant, the surface density, and so on from Gauss's law. And so if you just follow through the steps, you would be forced to conclude that there should be a gravitomagnetic term, and I'm going to use H to denote this gravitomagnetic field. And moreover, under a Lorentz transformation, the G and H fields transform almost identically with E and B. With one change of sign. And so there you have it, gravitomagnetism.
So at this point, it's that metal change, right? I mean, so.
I'm not even talking here about a field theoretic description. This is Newtonian gravity plus special relativity.
So no matter what, right? Like.
Well, we'll come to that. It will come to that.
Well, implicitly, it's saying there's 2 degrees of freedom as a magnet in some sense, right?
How do you say it?
Well, the thing is, G, there's only a scalar there, right? Because it's grad of a scalar, so there's only 1 degree of freedom.
No, I'll come back to the representation of G in more fundamental terms later on. Good point. Yes?
In Einstein's book, The Meaning of Relativity, he derives weak field approximation.
Yes.
His theory. He ends up, this was 1934.
Yes.
In fact, it leads to Lenz-Terrine solution.
that's correct, but it's not complete. Are there more questions or comments before I go on? Because this is a good point to stop and think.
So there should be a difference, because there you solve, for gravity, you solve geodesic equation. Here you're solving at the relativistic level. So they shouldn't be identical.
Right. That's true. If you assume general relativity at the outset, if you say particles should move along geodesics, the concept of geodesic doesn't even exist yet in what I have on the board.
Can I say something else? I remember that the charge is a Lorentz invariant, but the mass is not, right?
So no, this mass is Lorentz invariant. I'm assuming it in the derivation.
So.
Now, you all are recognizing there's some problems here. This can't be right. Gravity is not the same as electromagnetism.
But Newtonian gravity is static. You don't have this time derivative behavior in standard Newtonian physics.
Well, I've said nothing about the field equations. So there could be static field equations for Newtonian. And that would be consistent with Newtonian gravity extended to include these magnetic effects. So why am I making this derivation here, which is plainly has some difficulties? Well, it is because I believe this is how most people think about gravitomagnetism, that it must follow necessarily from combining Lorentz transformations with weak field gravity or Newtonian gravity. However, the matter is much more subtle. There are two serious problems with these results. First is that they're wrong. They're wrong according to general relativity. And I think there probably is enough experimental evidence in the binary pulsar system to say that they're plainly wrong. Period, independently of the theoretical framework. But there's a second problem. In Pauli's words, they're not even wrong. What I mean by that is these are based on applying concepts that have no business in curved space-time. The whole idea of a global Lorentz transformation is suspect in curved space-time. General relativity is founded on the principle of coordinate invariance. The equations of general relativity hold in any coordinate system. Well, take a curvilinear coordinate system in flat space. Take spherical polar coordinates. How do you Lorentz transform the components of a vector represented in spherical polar coordinates and time? It just doesn't make any sense.
An equation around in cosmic space, and you get a Lorentz invariant equation, which is just the, you know, the Fitts-Pauli, whatever you want to call it. I mean, so
well,
that's Lorentz invariant.
We will. Well, it's sure it's Lorentz. It's Lorentz covariant, and it's true that if you restrict yourself to weak fields, and you write your metric in an almost flat way, and those two are two separate restrictions, then you can recover a linearized theory in which the existence of Lorentz transformations makes sense, and you can develop the whole theory. That's true. But that's a rather limiting description. It's very tedious to build up the full general theory, starting from weak fields and the Lorentz covariance. And certainly in the standard presentations of general relativity, the coordinate freedom is built in at the outset. And there's no preference at all for frames that are almost flat, or for coordinates, I should say, that are almost Minkowskian.
But we have a post-Newtonian calculation, and if you do the post-Newtonian calculations, then which agree with the experiment, by the way.
Oh, I quite agree, and there's
you get this result.
There's not quite. We'll see what you get in a kind of a post-Newtonian framework. It'll become clear very shortly why you can't get exactly this result. There's no problem with doing perturbation theory, with doing post-Newtonian expansions, except that one loses sight of the underlying simplicity of the theory. And what I want to show you today is how magnetism looks like in another framework called the tetrad formulation, which in some sense restores Lorentz symmetry to general relativity. General relativity is supposed to generalize special relativity, but in so doing, it practically destroys the concept of Lorentz invariance, at least globally. There's not much point in pursuing Lorentz transformations with an arbitrary metric. Okay, so what does one do then? How is one going to recover a description similar to this, without working in a post-Newtonian framework? That's what I want to talk about now. So let's start from general relativity. And ask us how the geodesic equation looks like if we write it similarly to Newton's second law or the Lorentz force law. Okay, so there we have the geodesic equation. I'm writing it using momenta rather than four velocities, simply to carry along the correspondence with electromagnetism. Now, this resembles the Lorentz force law. which I will also write as a tensor equation here, but with a different set of indices. There are a few differences besides the indices, and that's actually the major difference. But one reason why that equation, which is linear in the velocity, can't be correct is that the geodesic equation involves two powers over four velocity. So there have to be quadratic velocity terms in any equation of motion for components and not merely linear ones. But the indices are more than a technical difference. These are entirely different spaces, tensor spaces, in which the indices live. In electromagnetism, in special relativity, there's a globally flat manifold. In general relativity, we have a curved space-time manifold. And what I want to do is glue the two together by introducing the idea of Lorentz frames at each space-time event. Space-time manifold structure of general relativity, and at some event, at some space-time point x, I'm going to add a little set of vectors which denote a local Lorentz frame, and these vectors denote EA. Four of them, and A will go from 0 to 3, just like in the Lorentz indices. Of course, at a different space-time event, I have a different tetrad, or set of four basis vectors. And now, any vector in the manifold can equally be represented in the coordinate basis or in this tetrad basis. And the tetrad basis is really convenient because quantities expressed that way conform to measurements in a local Lorentz frame.
Well, they do it if I propagate them in a certain way, right?
No, they always do. I'll come to the propagation in a moment. What I'm doing here is I'm adding more structure to general relativity in order to restore Lorentz symmetry. Here is an exact local symmetry of the theory. So I have this field that relates the two bases. This is very similar to the construction in field theory, where there is an internal space, a symmetry representing the symmetry group, let's say, of the standard model at each point in space-time. The difference, however, is the existence of this tetrad, which relates the two bases, because in this instance, the internal space is actually intimately related to the geometry. And if you want to think about it, one way is that what we're doing is to gauge a global Lorentz symmetry in special relativity by making it local. That is, allowing for local Lorentz transformations within this
orthonormal space at each point in the manifold. But we're gauging these Lorentz transformations here are applying not to a spin system, say, or to, let's say, color indices in QCD, but they actually apply to the space-time manifold itself. In special relativity, Lorentz transformation mixes the coordinates. So this is a little bit different from a fiber bundle in a gauge theory. It's a very particular one because we have to introduce this additional structure of this tetrad.
That's introduced through assuming a local inertial frame.
Sorry, yes, exactly.
I'm
a local inertial frame.
Emphasizing a local. But you don't end up with global Lorentz invariants. It's a local inertial frame.
Oh, that's right. And we'll come to local versus global symmetries in a moment.
Because of the orthonormality of the tetrads, you can go from curvilinear metric to the tetrad. They just go from one to the other.
Oh, sure. These two descriptions are
equivalent.
Are equivalent, except I'm actually building in something that's a little bit richer, and we'll give a natural way of writing electromagnetic forces, as you'll see, as you probably already anticipate. A further thing, I mean, this is implied by what you say, is that there are different bases at different points, and so the bases are related. So there's this object, which sometimes is called the spin connection, also known as Ricci rotation coefficients. I like to call it the Lorentz connection. It's a gauge connection for the local Lorentz symmetry. And many of you will recognize that this is exactly the approach one needs to add spinners to general relativity, for instance. I'm not going to talk about spins. I'm going to talk about classical point particles here, non-spinning particles, and look at how we describe magnetic effects. So now I'm going to take this equation and rewrite it using the orthonormal components. Same form. And now we have the advantage that at least for the Lorentz indices, we can treat these as four vectors in local Lorentz frames. We can do everything that we would in the case of electromagnetism or any theory in special relativity, and then examine the motion. Now, that sounds great. One concern, though, is whether this object really is a tensor. Because you know well that the Christoffel connection of general relativity is not a tensor. You can make a coordinate transformation so that this object and its first derivatives vanish at any point in the manifold. That's the transformation to coordinates of a freely falling frame, for example. What about this connection? Well, it turns out that this connection is a tensor under coordinate transformations. So one form. Okay, so you cannot make it zero by performing a coordinate transformation, unlike this object. Well, that's rather interesting. But there is a second type of transformation that one can make now because I've added more structure to the theory, and that is a Lorentz transformation associated with this internal, if you like, symmetry at each point in the manifold. So I have two kinds of transformations or symmetries. And the Lorentz transformations could be applied independently at each point in the manifold. That's where, after all, these internal spaces exist. So let's ask what happens to this connection under a Lorentz transformation. And that really gets to the heart of general relativity in the tetrad formulation.
Do you think the derivative is the covalent derivative to EA or ordinary derivatives to EA? The definition. Partial mu,
below.
Do you think that is partial mu or grad mu?
This is a partial mu.
A partial mu.
This is a partial x mu.
Just defines a covariant derivative.
Yeah.
Because the omega is like the connection in the Yang-Mills theory.
Exactly. Exactly. So if I want to, if I have some vector field, and I want to get an object that transforms as a vector under Lorentz transformations, because that's all I have here. This is a scalar under coordinate transformations. Then I can define a d mu va such that under Lorentz transformations, which means that VA goes to lambda AB B, okay. You can verify that under a Lorentz transformation, this covariant derivative transforms appropriately to a vector under this transformation, provided that the spin connection or this Lorentz connection transforms in the following way. I'm going to write this carefully with the indices. Two terms, very similar to the coordinate transformation of the Christoffel connection. You get one term which is tensor-like, and a second term that involves the derivatives of the transformation matrix. For a coordinate transformation, the transformation matrix is the Jacobian, the derivative of the coordinate transformation, so you get a second derivative of the coordinates for transforming the Christoffels. But for transforming this Lorentz connection, you just get a derivative of Lorentz transformation matrix. And again, this is very similar for any local field theory. So a couple of consequences you can draw from this. One is that this object omega is a tensor under what I can call global Lorentz transformations, that is, a constant matrix lambda of x, that is, where there's no x dependence. And this might seem a little bit strange that you have Lorentz frames tied to each space-time event, and you're going to make a simultaneous transformation of frames for all of those, at all of those events with the same matrix, but why not? We do that in special relativity. There's a frame at each event, and when we make a global Lorentz transformation, we transform those frames at every event by the same matrix. There we happen to forget that the frames are the same. We identify them in the flat manifold. But we don't have to. We can make it explicit here that we have the possibility of different frames at each space-time event, and yet imagine transforming with a constant matrix. You might ask why would you even think to do such a thing? Well, remember electromagnetism. Does electromagnetism break down if you have different frames at different points? No. Why can't I embed electromagnetism in accelerating frames, even in flat space-time? In that case, the electromagnetic force law is not correct the way it's written. It's not covariant. And one would be forced to add connection terms like those I have here. So, in other words, if global Lorentz frames are good for electromagnetism, then they ought to be equally good for gravity. Second consequence, of course, is that under a local Lorentz transformation, omega is not a tensor. So it's a tensor under a restricted class of transformations, and objects with that property are sometimes called pseudotensors. An example is the famous Landau-Lifshitz energy-momentum pseudotensor of gravitation.
That tells you if the transformation is global or local.
The transformation is independent of the tetrad. The transformation, global or local, just refers to whether this boost, this transformation field lambda, is coordinate dependent or not. Whether it's a set of constant, whether it's a constant matrix, or not. If it's a constant matrix that is the same matrix at every space-time event, then it's a global transformation. So distinguish transformation between the properties of the background space-time or the connection itself. I think I confused you. Ask some more questions.
Yeah. In field theory, you have to distinguish between abelian field theory and non-abelian.
This is a non-abelian gauge theory.
You have a non-abelian local gauge theory.
Sure.
But the abelian is the old-fashioned QED.
Right.
And there you do have a restricted gauge transformation.
Yes, and?
And but this is kind of related to what you're doing here by making a restricted transformation. You're treating omega mu as if it were an abelian theory, an abelian connection.
That's not quite so.
It's just a phase.
Because even in QED, if I looked at the U1 symmetry and transformed, in that case, the gauge field, so I would transform. Transform wave functions by mutual phase factor for U1 field. I would have a gauge covariant derivative where the gauge field transforms by the gradient of that. What I've written here is not quite right. Let me call this d mu lambda, and I imagine multiplying this by. Imagine multiplying a wave function by a phase factor, e to the i q lambda of x. So I'm just confusing myself a bit with the notation because I was thinking of phi as being the phase of the wave function. I want the change of phase of the wave function. So that's an abelian theory, and yet it does have these gradient corrections to the gauge field. The difference is that there are no internal space-time indices. There's only the derivative. So non-abelian theory is one where you have some group structure to your transformation law where the generators obey Lie algebra. And of course, we can use that and develop general relativity in the language of this Lorentz connection by defining a curvature using the structure constants of that Lie group, making a gauge covariant derivative of the gauge field. And one can, of course, use that to develop a whole treatment of gravitation. And of course, that's the starting point in Rovelli's book on loop quantum gravity. But that is not what I'm after here.
Yes, because Einstein gravity theory is not a Yang-Mills theory. People have tried to make it Yang-Mills, so it becomes renormalized.
Sure.
But they all fail.
Well, the action is not the Yang-Mills action. It's a gauge theory in the sense that one can write a gauge invariant action that is exactly equivalent classically to general relativity. I'm not going to talk about the dynamics of the field today. I'm restricting myself merely to the geodesic equation, and it's a much simpler question of how is this like electromagnetic forces on a charged particle. So all very good points, and maybe you are several steps ahead of me, but probably not everyone here is familiar with the Yang-Mills theories and with this treatment of gravity. So I wanted to keep things a little simple. Okay, are there further questions before I now decompose this and tell you about magnetic forces, gravitomagnetism itself, and its effect on gyroscopes and orbits? Any further questions? Okay. So I'm looking for my erasers. All right, so I'm going to take this equation and write it in a way that looks a little bit like the Lorentz force law. And we'll find out Lorentz transformations of various fields. And remember, I have two powers of the momentum. I'm going to define going to use an uppercase indices for those in the Lorentz frame. E is the energy of the particle measured in the Lorentz frame. And I'll use the Latin indices lowercase for space-time indices. I could get rid of the space-time index by introducing the inverse tetrad and converting that to a Lorentz index. But there's not only no advantage to doing that, there is harm doing it because it obscures the geometric nature of this connection, which really does involve derivatives of fields between points. So anyway, with this split of components in a local Lorentz frame, and I'm going to do something very peculiar here by writing a derivative with respect to the t coordinate. So this is really not covariant. This is x0 here. And this is the components in a local Lorentz frame. But this is an awful lot like what one does in electromagnetism.
and I'm introducing some fields. I will define. Sorry, that got a little crunched there. But now this so I'm just taking the components of this, let's call it field strength tensor, this Lorentz connection, because it's like the Maxwell field strength tensor. And remember, in the Maxwell case, you call F0i the electric field, and Fij is the epsilon ijk, that's the Levi-Civita permutation symbol, times the magnetic field. So it's very similar here, except I have an extra index, and so I have to keep track of whether the space-time index is time or space components. And so I get four fields, and I get two powers of velocity. Okay. This is exact. No weak field, no post-Newtonian. Works for any coordinate system, no matter how curved, as long as it's not at a singularity, and any Lorentz frame. So fully. This is a fully covariant equation, provided one specifies how these fields transform. And I have done so. I've told you how they transform under Lorentz transformations explicitly. And I've told you that this Lorentz connection is a one-form under coordinate transformations, which means that it merely transforms by the Jacobian partial derivative factors. So we're done. This describes the motion of a particle. And it compares well with the Lorentz force. The PDT, well, let's look at it. In place of the charge Q, or the mass M, which I had before, now I have the energy E. And someone was asking me whether the mass is Lorentz invariant. Well, this E is not. Okay. So that's a difference with the naive Newtonian plus special relativity treatment. There are these factors. M and N. The N field gives this quadratic correction. The M field gives what? Well, why did I group the terms like this? Why did I take this term that's linear in the velocity and distinguish it from this other term that's linear in the velocity? The reason I did so is that under global Lorentz transformations, that is, Lorentz transformations with a constant matrix so that this correction term in the transform vanishes, under global Lorentz transformations, G and M, on their Lorentz indices, transform exactly like electric fields. And omega and N transform exactly like magnetic fields. So there is not one simple gravito-magnetic field, nor is there one simple gravito-electric field.
The classical transformation where you can restrict to m equal to 0 n equal, and n equal to 0, which would give you the precise analogy.
You can. I don't know if that would be very useful. Perhaps more useful would be for me to write down the weak field case. And we can look then in sort of the post-Newtonian limit. So let's do that next.
So you could have, of course, absorbed E in these definitions, right? Or couldn't you?
You want to take the Lorentz factor that saying E is gamma times mass and absorb that into those fields. You could, but then then these G and M fields would no longer transform like electric fields. They would get extra powers of the gamma factor. And what's more, the G and the M, the fields would no longer be components of this Lorentz connection. The reason why this is an energy E instead of a mass M is because of this dT. I took the equation in the upper box there and I multiplied it by d tau over dt.
I'm puzzled because in tetrahedral theory, I know how to derive the Christoffel symbols from the spin connection.
Right.
Using the orthonormality of the.
Right, why you do that?
And I can do it exactly.
Sure.
And I will end up with the thing translated into space time. And they have to be identical. They have to be, by definition.
So this, in other words, has to be identical with the geodesic equation.
Curved space-time.
This is curved space time.
No, no, but I mean, you can always go from field by language to metric rel space language. Exactly.
Sure. And there is a relation. Here, I'll write it in. Do I want to write it?
Sorry.
No, I don't think I want to write it. There's a relation between omega and gamma, the Christoffel connection,
yeah,
which you're familiar with, and the rest of the experts are too. So, in that sense, I'm merely repackaging the geodesic equation and the usual description in curved space.
Have to get the same answer.
Of course, you have to get the same answer. But this repackaging is actually useful because it allows me to discuss electric and magnetic concepts in local frames where they make sense and where they're unambiguous. I know the transformation properties of the fields. I have a good reason for calling these electric and magnetic. This would be like E plus V cross V. You see the cross product. This is not a curved space-time object. This epsilon is the flat Levi-Civita symbol.
Yeah, sorry, I don't want to keep interrupting, but if you take what you get in the Weyl space and you do a weak field approximation.
Yes.
Gravity is very weak.
Yes.
Then you would get back what Einstein got in 1934. You have to.
Well, let's look and see if we do.
Yeah. Otherwise, you'll find being puzzled here.
So for the weak field limit, it means determining this connection or setting a connection from the metric. So I'm going to write a metric because it means the coordinates are almost flat. And so I'm going to write a line element. Where wi, hij, and this phi are all small, much less than one in magnitude. And you can choose your Lorentz frames. So that E sub 0, that's capital A equals 0, is the four velocity of a what I like to call a coordinate stationary observer, which is just an observer standing at fixed spatial coordinates, x, y, z. Okay. And see, I have to choose not only a metric here, but I have to choose the Lorentz frame.
So I'm going to pin the Lorentz frame to the coordinates, and then I'm going to rotate through the spatial rotation to align that frame as best I can with the coordinates. And there's, of course, freedom in here. If this hij isn't diagonal, for example, there's issues there, but I'm not going to go into that here. And so if you do a sensible definition of Lorentz frames, then what you find looks an awful lot like electromagnetism. So let's just focus for a second on the pieces, the G and the omega, which you might have thought should correspond to electromagnetic fields. This is exactly the expression for the electric field given a scalar potential phi and a vector potential W. It's A. Find this formula in any advanced C&M book. Magnetic field, though, this omega, is not curl of the vector potential. It's got a factor of -1/2. But in addition, there's this M field, which has a curl of W, which is magnetic-like in its appearance, but that field transforms in an electric-like way. And then there's this N term. And in the weak field limit, all of those four fields make a contribution. Of course, for the motion of a particle, this n term gets multiplied by 2 powers of the velocity. So this might be really small, let's say, for the lunar orbit or for the orbit of a satellite. But of course, I also want to apply this framework to spin precession to talk about, let's say, the precession of gyroscopes in gravity probe B, where just to leap ahead to what that will look like. ds dt, well, let me write it in the covariant form. The spin is parallel transported. This is the equation of parallel transport. And so it has only 1 power of the momentum. So when you look at spin precession, then this n term actually can be important as well, even for gravity probe B, even for a non-relativistic system. So I suspect if you compare these with Einstein 1934 as meaning of relativity, you'll find they're equivalent. But I have to caution you one thing. There is a difference between components in the Lorentz frame and components in a coordinate frame. You have to use the tetrad matrix, the Veerbind, to relate them. And when you take a derivative of, let's say, a four-velocity component in the coordinate frame, you also have to then differentiate the Veerbind. And that will tend to give you corrections to these fields. And it makes the results look not nearly as simple. So let me try to wrap up by just expressing where this all goes, what you can learn from doing, taking weak fields or strong fields as you like. Let me just briefly summarize some of the ideas and then conclude.
if you take these weak field formulae and insert them into this, you'll see that the m and the omega terms both have this curl of W type behavior. And if you neglect time derivatives of the metric, so if you've got a static metric, and you neglect the order v squared terms from this n, so you neglect the n terms, and you only keep the part of the m term that comes from the curl of W, then you end up with and when I'm writing with underscores and flat space-time notation, I really mean that. I'm working with derivatives in this flat background space, and these are just the ordinary three vectors of Euclidean space. In the weak field limit, you can treat the fields as being fields on Euclidean space and time. This factor of two, you can see that curl of W is minus 2 omega. But where it really comes, so if you look at this term, this is an omega cross V, but you have to combine with the term from M. And when you combine it with the term of curl W from M, you end up getting a single term, which is minus 2 V cross omega. Let me write that another way just so that you, because I want to write this another way. Some of you might recognize this as what? What is this? What is this 2 omega cross V? Where does that show up in physics?
Coriolis.
It's a Coriolis force. It is a Coriolis force. In fact, you can transform this term away by making a spatially varying rotation, Lorentz rotation. Just like you can transform away this G term by making a spatially varying or time varying Lorentz boost. Along a particle's whirl line, boost to its instantaneous frame. The particle accelerates. Make a further boost to a different frame. Make a time and space varying Lorentz transformation, and you can eliminate both of these terms at any point in space-time or along a particle's trajectory. And of course, that's why gravity is not a tensor force. It's not covariant. It is a pseudo-force. But I would go one step further and say that this gives us a lot of insight into gravity, because Einstein first came up with this curved space-time description when he tried to reconcile special relativity with the equivalence principle. And normally, we think about the equivalence principle when we recall Einstein's viewing the painter painting his house and falling. And Einstein called that his happiest day, his happiest moment. I'm sure it wasn't the painter's happiest moment. There was no force in the painter's frame. The painter performed a sequence of Lorentz transformations that kept the painter at rest in his own frame. Is that the only equivalence principle? No, it's not, because there are also these magnetic-like effects. And when people talk about the dragging of inertial frames, what they really mean is that if you want to go into a truly inertial frame, then you should perform a rotation that's spatially dependent. So magnetic effects are equivalent to frame dragging effects. And the relation is right here. Okay, and I'm glossing over exactly how you would perform those transformations, but that'll be in the paper that Raman and I are working on.
Right. Because you're saying rotation actually enters both in electric and magnetic. and it's the same term, but one transforms like electric field, the other transforms like magnetic field. So that's that contradiction.
That is a big part of the confusion in this subject. That there are magnetic effects in the Lorentz force law, and there are magnetic properties in the transformations of fields, and they are not the same in gravity as they are in electromagnetism. I think I'm going to actually stop the formal presentation here because I've gone a little bit past an hour, and it would be better, I think, not to introduce any new subject, but just leave any further time remaining for questions and discussion. And thank you very much.
So we're going to take it to dinner, probably somewhere. I'm not sure, we can decide. But let's meet at around 6:30. Those who want to join us in the lobby. And Ed is going to be here until Monday at midday, or is that?
Yeah, midday Monday.
Midday Monday. Okay, questions? But actually, John, maybe somebody else.
Sorry.
So somebody else wants to ask a question. This is your chance.
This is how you get to geodesic, the very end of your thing.
So I have to caution you about one thing. I've told you how the components of momentum change with time. That's not the same thing as giving you the world line of a particle. So to get the world line of a particle, I still have to integrate p is m dv dt. And then I have to worry about the fact that the Lorentz components of v are not the same as the space components dx dt over velocity. So I need another tetrad in there.
Okay, sorry.
The good news is that in the weak field limit, then you're safe because all the contributions to dv dt are first order in the metric, and so you can just replace the tetrad there by the identity.
So the when we talk normally talk about frame dragging, we don't mean the Coriolis effect. So this particular thing is frame dragging, but the Coriolis effect should also show up somewhere in there. So can we tell them apart, or are they the same thing in this?
When I read about frame dragging, let's say Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, there are two aspects. One is at the ergosphere of the black hole, where you're forced into rotation. But there is another effect, which is that if you hold a gyroscope, or you try to point your arm at the fixed stars, it will be swept around too. You're forced into rotation. The orientation of an inertial object is forced into rotation as well. So how do I want to say it? If I think about this as giving the motion of a particle, let's write this as mb squared x dt squared in a weak field limit, then this really is the same frame dragging that occurs at the ergosphere of the black hole, but in the weak field limit. I would go a little further, and I like to think about frame dragging in terms of gyroscope precession. And basically, this equation says that a gyroscope wants to keep pointing in a fixed inertial direction in its own inertial frame.
So for the gyroscope, it would be the n term, it would not be the only term.
The gyroscope gets a contribution definitely from the omega term. Let's go to the gyroscope frame where S is space-like. So I would have a zero, A would be a spatial index, and then, you're right. In the gyroscope frame, if this is space-like, then I only get the spatial components, so I get the N term. Exactly right. I didn't talk about lunar laser ranging and so on. There's been some controversy in the literature about whether lunar laser ranging measures the same thing as gravity probe B was trying to measure. It doesn't. It's unambiguous. It doesn't. Does it measure a magnetic-like effect? Well, yes, but that's entirely frame dependent. Depending on whether you choose to describe lunar laser ranging in a geocentric frame or in a heliocentric frame. And I don't really have much more to say, except there have been a couple of papers in PhysRev and PhysRev letters arguing needlessly about this point. And what I try to say today is that a lot of this business about gravitomagnetism is semantics, and what I'm trying to do here is to extract or isolate things that have physical meaning from the semantics.
Am I allowed to ask a question? Let someone else ask a question. If I can get time.
No, I think you read it long enough.
Thank you. So, some years ago, I spent 6 months starting to leave at Stanford. And Francis Everett urged me to redo Schiff's calculations. Mm-hmm. And he gave me the original notes from Schiff. And I did that. And then I also did the Fehrbein calculation. And I put it back into curved space-time. I did post-Newtonian, and I got these answers. In fact, these answers are in Steve Weinberg's book, Gravitational Cosmology. If you look, he does a post-Newtonian calculation, he gets this result. Also, he gets that from a geodesic. He does the spin precession through what he calls SA. So, this is correct.
So that's the rare stamp of approval from John. It's very hard to get through. So,
correct, and whether it's interesting or not will be for the rest of you.
So, any questions? I guess, James.
So I guess, not knowing anything about this, I'm confused about the status of these experiments. I mean, first of all, I presume this is always small, unless in effect you have a system rotating at close to the speed of light.
That's right.
And that's roughly how, say, the lunar experiments will scale. They're scaling roughly as the rotation over.
Actually, for the lunar laser ranging, the magnetic, the gravitomagnetic field caused by the Earth's rotation, I haven't talked about what form W takes for a rotating body, for instance, mm-hmm. is entirely negligible. And that's exactly why lunar laser ranging does not measure the same thing as gravity probe B. The so-called gyroscope precession or pew shift precession, because there was an independent paper by a man named Pew in 1960, measure two very different things. The pew shift precession depends on the rotation of the Earth, depends on the angular velocity of the Earth, and the lunar laser ranging does not. Lunar laser ranging has to do with the precession of the moon's orbit, and it is actually Lenz-Tearing. Well, even that's not quite true. Lenz-Tearing precession also originates from the field of a spinning body. But there are magnetic-like effects in the precession of the moon's orbit. If you look in the sun's, in the solar heliocentric rest frame, and that's because the moving Earth creates a mass current, which generates a gravitomagnetic field that then acts on the moving moon. So you can see right there that there's two powers of velocity that are present in that relativistic effect, and then therefore it's a rather small effect. And not easy to measure, and it's a triumph of lunar laser ranging measurements that they've been able to do so.
And are there obvious alternatives in these measurements? I mean, obvious alternative predictions?
There are a lot of terms that come in when you do a careful calculation. For example, with gyroscope precession, if you work in the frame of the gyroscope, there are terms that come in from differentiating the tetrad matrix, and those give an effect similar to Thomas precession in atomic physics, which originates from a sequence of Lorentz boosts that an electron makes orbiting a nucleus, and that modifies this spin-orbit coupling. Same thing happens in gravity. There are also effects coming from the M and the N terms. The N term in particular that involve the spatial part of the metric, and so those give post-Newtonian factors in gyroscope precession, and ideally gravity probe B would be able to measure those and test the post-Newtonian prediction.
Okay, perfect. No more questions?